This is Free Speech Radio News for Wednesday, April 17th, 2013. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina. Coming up, more details emerge about the bombing at the Boston Marathon as an FBI investigation continues and local residents plan memorials, vigils, and other responses to the attack. In Washington, lawmakers unveil an immigration reform bill. It provides a path to citizenship for some, but draws criticism for increased militarization of the border. And we'll go to the West Bank, where Palestinians protest indefinite detention in Israel, and concern grows over the health of long-term hunger strikers. Those stories and more coming up.
I'm Jess Burns with headlines for FSRN. Officials continue to investigate the twin bombings at the Boston Marathon Monday. Boston police posted on social media that widely circulating reports of a suspect in custody are not true. More fragments of the so-called pressure cooker bomb have been found. Officials have identified the third victim as Lingzi Liu, a Chinese graduate student at Boston University. The two others have been identified as 8-year-old Martin Richard and 29-year-old Crystal Campbell. The FBI has found a second letter containing the toxin ricin at a male screening facility. The letter was addressed to President Obama. A third letter to an undisclosed addressee is also being tested. The FBI says it does not believe the letters have any connection to the marathon bombing. The Supreme Court ruled unanimously today that U.S. federal courts do not have the jurisdiction to hold international companies accountable for human rights violations committed outside the United States. The case was brought by Nigerian nationals who came to the U.S. seeking asylum. They charged under the Alien Tort Statute that certain international corporations, including Royal Dutch Shell, aided and abetted the Nigerian government in committing violations of international law, such as extrajudicial killings, torture, arbitrary arrest, and property destruction. The court ruled that the Alien Tort Statute does not cover the actions of international corporations abroad. As more Americans feel the effect of across-the-board spending cuts known as the sequester, progressive lawmakers have introduced legislation to create a Wall Street sales tax that would generate billions of dollars in revenue. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Anna Simonton has more.
The Inclusive Prosperity Act would implement a financial transaction tax on Wall Street trading, 0.5% for stocks and less on derivatives and bonds. The bill's authors say the tax is not enough to negatively impact investors, but would add up to $350 billion in revenue per year, which would be channeled to healthcare, education, creating living wage jobs, and tackling climate change. Democrat Keith Ellison said today the tax would also benefit the economy.
By adopting this tiny fee to stock transactions, we can reduce harmful financial market speculation, discourage high volume, high speed trading, and slow down the proliferation of ever more complex derivatives.
A coalition of more than 150 national organizations called the Robin Hood Tax Campaign is pushing for the bill's passage. Many of the groups will rally outside the International Monetary Fund and World Bank this Saturday before marching to the White House and Treasury Department. Several European Union countries are currently implementing a transaction tax as well. Anna Simonton, FSRN, Washington, D.C.
A Texas Senate committee passed legislation Tuesday that would make it more difficult for local governments and citizens to take legal action against polluters. FSRN's Teddy Wilson has more.
The bill, just passed out of the Senate Natural Resources Committee, would put limits on the resources available to local communities to challenge state pollution permits. Senate Bill 957 would apply to permits for injection wells, often used in fracking, uranium mines, landfills, hazardous waste treatment facilities, and concrete plants. The bill shifts the burden of proof from the company seeking the permit to the challenger. It also changes hearings by limiting the time, scope, and participants allowed. Environmental groups have spoken out against the legislation, saying that it weakens already limited regulations. According to the Texas Observer, the bill has largely been supported by industry groups such as the Texas Chemical Council and the Texas Association of Business. It now goes before the full Senate. The Texas House is also seeking to limit efforts to rein in polluters. Proposed legislation there would ban local governments from hiring lawyers paid only in the case of a favorable result. Teddy Wilson, FSRN, Texas.
Lawmakers in New Zealand have given approval to legislation allowing same-sex marriage. Weeks of debate preceded the final vote Tuesday evening, where a majority of parliament members defended marriage equality. MP Maurice Williamson said he respected opponents who brought concerns to the table, but chided extremists.
Well, I found some of the bullying tactics really evil.
He described feedback and threats he'd received from people in his district.
But I give a promise to those people who are opposed to this bill right now. I give you a watertight, guaranteed promise. The sun will still rise tomorrow. Your teenage daughter will still argue back with you as if she knows everything. Your mortgage will not grow. You will not have skin diseases or rashes or toads in your bed, sir. The world will just carry on. So don't make this into a big deal. This is fantastic for the people it affects, but for the rest of us, life will go on.
The measure passed 77 to 44. A signature by the Governor General is necessary, but that's generally considered a technicality. Similar legislation in Uruguay awaits a signature by the president. And that's headlines for FSRN. From Eugene, Oregon, I'm Jess Burns.
I'm Dorian Marina in Los Angeles. In Boston, area hospitals continue to treat patients injured from Monday's explosions near the finish line of the marathon. Doctors at the Boston Medical Center say that a 5-year-old boy is among the patients who remain in critical condition. Dr. Peter Burke, chief trauma surgeon, told reporters at a briefing this morning that 19 patients remained at that facility, 2 in critical condition, 10 serious, and more surgeries are planned today. Authorities say 176 people were initially brought to area hospitals after the explosions. Burke said many of the injuries are focused on lower extremities, where people were hit by shrapnel and fragments from the explosion.
So initially, we're worried about life-saving maneuvers, stopping the bleeding and things like that, stabilizing patients so that we can deal with their injuries over time. But it's really important for people to realize that this is something that they get injured really quickly, but it takes a long time for the people to get better, and there are lots of steps in that process.
Burke also said that post-traumatic stress disorder for survivors and families is a concern as they continue treatment.
And we try to get to be sensitive and to work with these patients and their families as well. PTSD is not just about the patients, it's about their families as well. And we work with them from the beginning.
Hundreds gathered for vigils in Boston and Dorchester last night, and more events are planned in the city and across the nation. President Obama is scheduled to visit Boston tomorrow and attend an interfaith service. Some residents are also organizing listening circles where those affected by the attack can address the incident and the effect on their community. One of those who's helping to organize the effort for Boston residents and for people in other areas is Darcy Shaver. She's an empathetic responder. She joins us from Portland, Oregon. Welcome to FSRN.
Thanks for having me here, Dorian.
First, what is an empathy circle and how does it work?
An empathy circle is a gathering of people, those who want to be heard or acknowledged around what's going on for them in that moment, and blended with people who are experienced active listeners or reflective listeners. That's generally what an empathy circle looks like. An empathy circle is similar to having a conversation with good friends sometimes. In the professional sense, it's a gathering of people, you know, who are facilitators, listeners, and people who need to be heard.
And we've spoken to people in Boston who expressed confusion, fear. We've seen a range of responses. We heard from medical professionals who talk about possibilities of PTSD going forward. How does your work deal with an event like this, and why is it important?
An empathy circle is important in that it catches people in the moment of where they are and what they're feeling and experiencing, and it really lends validity to what's going on for them. It basically allows them a platform for being heard very deeply about what they're feeling. And it also helps them access a better sense of what it is that they're needing, you know, things like security, community, some authenticity, honesty, transparency, those sorts of things.
Where have you done these kinds of empathy circles in the past? What kind of circumstances did they come from, and what was the outcome?
Well, it's interesting. It's not a terribly well-known phenomenon in being called an empathy circle, but you can find these sorts of things in communication methods, somewhat like popcorn-style discussion circles. It's the very same concept that you have in spaces like group therapy. So I need to be clear that an empathy circle is not meant to be therapy. I can say that personally, as I facilitate a motherless daughters group, it's a grief support group, I basically am creating an empathy circle where I am listening deeply to each participant, listening to what's going on for them, and just gently reflecting back to them what it is that they're telling me. And in doing that, it's kind of clarifying for them what it is they're feeling and needing in that moment.
Darcy Shaver, you're coordinating a series of upcoming listening circles online and in the Boston area. You're working with people in the area. What have you heard from those in Boston who you're working with about the need for this event and its purpose moving forward?
Yeah, well, the purpose of this event, again, is just to help people get really deeply heard about what they feel in regard to what has happened. You know, there's fear, there's insecurity that's happening, there's anger, and, you know, then on the other hand, we've got some people who are feeling really hopeful about watching people come together. You know, we're going to explore all of that. So that's the purpose of this event, is to really highlight for people what is going on for them and help them move through to a space of feeling like they're starting to heal from this event.
And any other details about the specifics of this event, if you're planning on it taking place online or in a physical space, and the timeline as of this point?
As of this point, we're in the creation of a Facebook event that people can go to, and they can join it, the event there online, and we can allow for everybody to send out invitations to people that they know might need a service like this and some help. And we're doing it on that platform because, you know, it's very far-reaching pretty quickly, and we'd like to reach as many people as possible at once. We'll be making outside efforts to find people who are not online and, you know, do what we can to help them get online. And we'll be doing that sometime. We'll be clarifying and creating that event within the next 24 hours, in the hopes of holding the event early next week, and we'll be providing more information on that very soon.
Darcy Shaver is an empathetic responder. She's also one of the organizers of an online event called an Empathy Circle to take place in response to the attacks in Boston this week. Darcy Shaver, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
In Washington, senators unveiled the full text of a long-awaited immigration reform bill around 2 a.m. Wednesday morning. Immigrant rights groups are praising many of the bill's provisions, including an accelerated path to citizenship for youth eligible for the DREAM Act. But the proposal is also drawing criticism. Human rights defenders say there's nothing in the bill to address the root causes of immigration, and that the billions of dollars allocated for further border militarization will only put migrants in further danger. And some Republican lawmakers are already vowing to oppose the bill, saying that anyone who entered the country without permission should not have the opportunity to become a U.S. citizen. On Capitol Hill, FSRN's Alice Olstein has more.
The first section of the more than 800-page Senate immigration reform bill concerns border security. allocating more than $4.5 billion to putting more armed officers, surveillance drones, and double and triple layer fencing on the U.S.-Mexico border. The bill's Democratic and Republican authors claim this will, quote, secure our borders and keep our country safe and prosperous. But those who live in the border region, like human rights advocate Silvia Grijalva in Ciudad Juarez, says this is merely a continuation of an inhumane border strategy that doesn't work.
Sí, la militarización en la frontera ha generado grandes muros, pues, para contener la migración.
The militarization of the border, building big walls to keep out migrants, that won't end migration. It only generated more violence against migrants, and it just makes them seek out other alternatives to cross the border, like going on foot through the Sonoran Desert in terrible, shameful conditions, conditions that end, for many, in death.
Under the new bill, the path to citizenship for most of the 11 million undocumented people living in the U.S. would be tied to these security measures. No one will be able to apply for registered provisional immigrant status, the first step on the path to citizenship, until Congress certifies that the Border Patrol has achieved persistent surveillance in high-risk border sectors. They would also have to successfully detain about 90% of migrants attempting to cross. The bill gives the Department of Homeland Security permission to waive any environmental, historical preservation, or landowner protection law that gets in the way of achieving these new goals. Once the border security measures are implemented, the U.S. will begin processing the applications of millions of undocumented people. The path to citizenship would take about 13 years for most immigrants. But under a provision of the bill similar to the DREAM Act, those who were brought to the country as children and are now enrolled in college or the military would have an expedited 5-year wait. Unlike past versions of the DREAM Act, this provision has no age limit and would allow some deported DREAMers to re-enter the country, provided they have no criminal record. One of those who would benefit is 22-year-old Maryland activist Raymond Jose, who came to the U.S. with his family from the Philippines at age 9. He says the bill's section on DREAMers looks great, but he'll demand changes for other undocumented people denied the same opportunities.
I don't want to forget about my family, my parents, who have sacrificed so much for me, and I don't want them to be left behind. Nobody should. And also, I really want it to be inclusive, and it's not inclusive to the LGBT community, and you know that's something that I feel strongly about. You know, my LGBT undocumented brothers and sisters have gone through the same struggles that I have, and then some. So why should they be left out of this? It's not right.
Despite many human rights advocates urging lawmakers to treat binational same-sex and opposite-sex couples equally, the bill does not do so. The legislation also bars anyone who entered the country after December 31, 2011, from applying for protected status. Mexican human rights advocate Alberto Ginotencatl works in the city of Saltillo with Central American migrants attempting to cross Mexico. Currently on a visit to Washington, he told FSRN the Senate immigration reform bill also fails to address the underlying conditions that motivate people to migrate.
In their countries of origin, there's no hope. They've tried to get work there, but what they earned wasn't enough to continue subsisting in a dignified way. They know the situation is terrible, but they're ready to risk their lives because they have nothing left to lose in their home countries.
Ginotencatl said if the U.S. government truly wants to reduce undocumented immigration, it should renegotiate its free trade agreements with Mexico and Central America. He also said the government should better control the trafficking of guns to Latin America, as organized crime and gang violence are other major factors in migrants fleeing to the U.S. The first hearing on the Senate immigration bill is scheduled for this Friday. Alice Holstein, Free Speech Radio News, Washington.
In Texas, civil rights advocates are pushing lawmakers to repeal a law they say discriminates against same-sex couples. The 15-year-old amendment restricts parents' names on birth certificates for adopted children to one man and one woman. Opponents say the provision isn't just discriminatory, it adds burden to everyday life. From Austin, FSRN's Andrew Oxford reports.
Texas legislators would only have to revise a few lines of state code, but that action could remove children adopted by same-sex couples from legal limbo.
In the adult world, sort of your standard form of ID is your driver's license. In the world of minor children, it's a birth certificate.
Chuck Smith is the executive director of Equality Texas, a group that advocates for the rights of LGBT Texans.
Up until 1997, the law read that the supplementary birth certificate of an adopted child should reflect the names of the adopted parents. That's pretty clear, it's pretty straightforward, and it's pretty damn logical, and ought to be, you know, that's what it should be. And it read that way until 97. It was changed at that point in time to make it gender specific, and the restrictions that were added said that one parent must be male who shall be the father, and one parent must be female who shall be the mother.
Under current law, an adopted child's birth certificate may only list one parent or neither of them if the parents are of the same gender. Thus, the adopted children of same-sex parents enter a legal gray area, whether they are enrolling in school, applying for a passport, or registering for Little League. Texas House Bill 201 would undo the statute that proponents of LGBT rights like Smith see as blatantly discriminatory.
These adoptive children are being penalized for no other reason than some people don't like who their parents are.
HB 201 would require the state's Bureau of Vital Statistics, which issues supplementary birth certificates for adopted children, to list a child's parents regardless of gender.
If you don't have a birth certificate with both parents on it, then one of those parents is going to be excluded from that child's life.
Karen Langsley is an attorney in Austin.
Children whose parents want to put them on their health insurance policy, if that child doesn't have a birth certificate with that parent's name on it, there's an impediment there.
The exclusion of one parent on a child's birth certificate creates bureaucratic headaches for some of Langsley's clients and parents such as herself. The problems can be every day.
When I enrolled my kids in school in this little district here in Texas, I was filling out the forms, and I said to this lady, I'm quaking in my boots, right, because I'm from San Francisco originally. I said, well, my kids don't have a mom and a dad. They have two moms, so what should I put here? And she goes, well, cross out father and put other mother. And I thought, that's the quintessential Texan.
HB 201 is currently in committee. Though similar bills have not moved forward in the state's last two legislative sessions, supporters hope that lawmakers will be more receptive as public opinion continues to shift on LGBT rights. Andrew Oxford, FSRN, Austin.
I'm Ralph Nader. Why do we need free speech radio news? With 200 reporters over six continents giving you the reality of the world and not taking any corporate money? The answer is in the question. If you really want to learn about what's going on in terms of the brutality around the world, the power of militarism and empire, how people are trying to preserve the planet from climate change to environmental improvement for farmers and consumers and workers, if you want to learn more about what people are really doing to fight back, people who are suffering but not giving up, you will listen to Free Speech Radio News. Free Speech Radio News cannot exist without your support. That's what makes it honest. The contact for your support, FSRN.org. Let's remember that, FSRN.org. They're waiting for your collaboration.
Across the West Bank and Gaza, Palestinians marked Prisoners' Day today with protests in numerous cities and towns. This year's annual event comes as four long-term hunger strikers continue refusing food to protest the Israeli army's ill treatment of them and the policy of administrative detention in which Palestinians are held indefinitely without charges. FSRN's Ghassan Bonora attended the main protest for the Prisoners' Day in Ramallah City.
Yeah. Dozens gathered here at Arafat Square in Ramallah City, chanting in support of hunger-striking detainee Samer Isawi, who has been on and off a hunger strike for more than 250 days. Isawi was released from 7 years of detention 2 years ago during the prisoner's swap deal between Israel and Palestinian groups in Gaza. But the army rearrested him last July, claiming he violated the deal's terms. Isawi's mother attended the protest.
I am demanding from all the free world, the free leaders, to work hard to release my son Samir. I am making this demand as a human being. Samir is a human being. He's not an olive tree. If they uproot it, we will plant a new one. Or a house. If they demolish it, we rebuild it once more. But he's a human being. And if he dies, he can't be replaced.
The Israeli army is currently holding Samer Isawi in a hospital, and his lawyers warn that his heart may fail at any time. Among those protesting for Isawi's release was Khadr Adnan, who was freed last year by the Israeli army after conducting a 66-day-long hunger strike.
I started my hunger strike in protest of my repeated arrest by the army. The way they violently interrogated me and the administrative detention. During my hunger strike, they used to insult me, put me in solitary confinement, force me to stand for long hours, and jail me with Israeli criminals to force me to stop my strike, but they failed.
According to the Palestinian Ministry of Political Detainees, since Israel occupied the West Bank and Gaza in 1967, its army has arrested 800,000 Palestinians, the equivalent of 20% of the entire population. 78,000 of those were arrested in the past 13 years. The ministry says the Israeli army currently holds 4,900 Palestinians in 17 detention centers in the West Bank and inside Israel. Randa Wahbe from Ad-Damir, the Association for Prisoner Support and Human Rights, said the conditions for Palestinian prisoners are deteriorating.
The situation of the prisoners right now is possibly the worst that it has been in years. We are seeing that there are that the situation is becoming increasingly dangerous for the prisoners. Not only are we seeing an increase in arrests, but we're seeing that the Israeli prison service and the military courts are no longer heeding to any of the calls or demands by international organizations or the prisoners themselves.
Two Palestinian prisoners died in Israeli army custody this year. In February, Arafat Jaradat died after being interrogated by the Israeli military. Palestinian officials accuse Israel of torturing him. Earlier this month, Maysara Abu Hamdiya died due to an advanced case of cancer that advocates say weren't treated in time. Palestinian political detainees announced a one-day hunger strike Wednesday. They also sent a letter to the Israeli prison administration warning that if they are not going to be treated as prisoners of war, they are going to escalate their protests. The detainees gave prison administration 45 days to respond to their demand. Ghassan Bannoura, FSRN, Ramallah.
And that's the program for today. The newscast was produced by Catherine Comp. Thanks for listening. In Los Angeles, I'm Dorian Marina.